Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As we approach the end of the year, GLT is looking back on some of the stories and interviews from 2018. Today, we bring you a selection of books and authors of local interest. An award-winning children's book author fought back against a triple threat of learning disabilities at a time when schools were little able to cope with kids who were different. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
The Bee Tree, Chicken Sunday, Thundercake. Those are just some of the more than 115 children's books published by writer Patricia Polacco, an impressive effort made all the more astonishing by the fact that Polacco didn't learn to read until she was 14 years old. Polacco says she struggled against dyslexia, dysnumeria, and dysgraphia.
So I've got those three and something called failure of sensory integration, which means I could not hold still. So an educator today, if they had me in their classroom, I think would be pretty worried.
How did your teachers deal with that when you were a child?
Well, when I was a kid, remember, they weren't trained to even understand what this is. They knew I was intelligent. What I'd hear them say to me all the time is, you're not applying yourself. You're not trying. I was trying with all my might, and I could not hold still. And I was a daydreamer. I was always looking out the window, and they'd say, Patricia, pay attention to what we're saying. I can actually look away from you and word for word tell you what you're saying. It was very difficult.
Yeah. But a teacher noticed what your problem was and helped you, and you actually immortalized that teacher in a book called Thank You, Mr. Faulker. Can you tell me about Mr. Faulker?
Well, what he had going for him is he owned also a theater downtown, and he did dinner theater. His background was more in theater as well as being an English major. And he was used to working with eccentric children. And he looked beyond what anyone else saw. Plus, he had issues in his own life. He was probably living what he considered a lie.
Was he closeted?
Yes. And I didn't find this out till 30 years later. And when I think of it, nobody could have helped me but him, because he knew what it was to live in a body that doesn't do what everybody says it has to, because mine sure didn't. But at any rate, he targeted the artwork. He was very fascinated because my particular disability, when one side of the brain is shut down, which was true, the other goes into hyperdrive, which was the artistic side. So at four, I could draw perspective. I understand congruency of three dimension. In my family, just to give you the background, the youngest child, about four, is going to go to school. They put a book in our hands. The family surrounds us, pours honey on the cover of the book. We're asked to taste it, and the family says, and what does this taste like? And we say, well, this is sweet. And they go, yes, and so is knowledge. But knowledge is like the bee that made the honey. You're going to have to chase it through the pages of a book. I could do enough to get by, but I was failing. So he saw an entirely different person. He asked me to come in and wash blackboards one night, and he put on My Fair Lady, I'll never forget it, and he brought his, I had a bucket and a sponge, and I'm going like 90 on the board, and he asked me to make letters and numbers, and for some reason moving from a horizontal to vertical, and much larger, he could see the code then. He knew I couldn't do it. And I remember literally dropping the sponge in the bucket, wanting to run. And I remember trying to back away, and he put his hand immediately in the center of my back and pushed me forward and dropped to a knee next to me. And the thing of it is, even today, when I come onto something that I don't think I can face, his hand is still in the center of my back. I can feel it. He said, you have something, I think, that has a name. He said, I can't help you, but I know someone who can. So Ruth Plessy came to work with me. My art teacher, Violet Chu. Because how I read, your listeners can't see this, but we're looking at an exit sign over above a door. Most people see the red letters. I see the gray metallic negative space around those letters. And Miss Chu put me in front of the books of M.C. Escher. And that's when I understood that I see negative space around positive matter. That's how I read. So it was the aha moment. And I remember running home that night, and I ran in the house and I grabbed a jar of honey out of the cupboard, and I went to my mother's bookshelf, poured the honey on the cover of the book, tasted it, and sat there and sobbed because I knew my life had changed.
Well, you changed your life again when you became a children's book author. You were 41 years old.
41.
That was a fresh plunge for you.
It was a fresh plunge because I restored icons for museums. But I'm good at it, but it wasn't feeding my soul. My beloved son was diagnosed with insulin-dependent diabetes. And we were sent home from the hospital with shopping bags of material he had to read. He was 9. So I did a book for him, a wordless book, just showing him what he had to do to get through one day. Most diabetics say, just tell me how to stay on my feet for one day. And then you repeat that day after day. And Thatcher Hurd was a friend of mine. Clement C. Hurd is his father. Clem Hurd and Margaret Wise Brown did Goodnight Moon. And Thatcher belonged to the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. He said, why don't you come along to meetings? Because I think you'd be good at this, because he saw that book. And that's how it all began. My mother bankrolled a trip for me to New York. I saw 16 publishers in 1 week and sold everything I had. And the rest is history.
Since you started over at the age of 41 mm-hmm. in a creative field, what advice can you give midlife people who might be thinking, you know what, I want to try something new. I want to go into mm-hmm. a creative endeavor. Do you have any advice?
Do it. It's scary. The reason people don't take risk is they're afraid of failure. No, they're not. They're afraid of success. Far trickier. When you are successful, the onus of performance is then on you. Failure, I mean, we do every day. I'm really good at it. But when you take a risk, and this is something I like to say to children and adults alike, the spectacular humans I have known have not necessarily been famous or remarkable in any way, but they took risk. If you don't try, you're never going to know. And then you're haunted by these feelings the rest of your life. Give it a try.
I have some shelves in my house, bookshelves, mm-hmm. full of my favorite books from childhood. I pick them up every now and again and
read them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that adults should do that?
Yes. Because if anything, it is going to put you in tune with a time when things were simpler, when you were being taken care of by another person. It gives you a time to exhale and relive this place of safety. Plus, the stories are lyrical. Of course, remember, my family being Russian, I was raised on, you know, some pretty serious Russian folklore, which is kind of unforgiving. But on the other hand, you know, I love Dr. Seuss, Robert McCloskey, all of these wonderful lyrical tales that still feed my soul, still do.
It's fun to look back at what you read maybe when you were 9 years old, mm-hmm. and then you think, oh, that's why I really like dragons, because mm-hmm. I read My Father's Dragon,
yeah.
and that's
yeah.
a sort of, it planted a seed, and then you can see, oh, I see where that came from. Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember, for instance, you remember the Seven Chinese Brothers?
Yes.
That was one of my favorites. The little engine that could was
I
one
like
of my favorites.
I like that
one. The little tugboat that comes around.
Mike Mulligan and his
yes,
steam shovel.
His steam shovel.
I love that one.
How does it make you feel? Knowing that the books that the kids are reading today that you have written are going to essentially be a part of their literary DNA for the rest of their lives.
Oh, there's nothing like it. To think that I would even be a part of that's a legacy that will be in this world long after this body is in a hole in the ground. I love the idea of it. I'm not lofty in that I think that I have that, you know, that my things are that great. I think there's a lot of literature out there that has impact on children today that is absolutely invaluable. Invaluable.
So when you're here working with all these kids, are you getting inspiration from mm-hmm. them?
Oh my, yes. One thing I do at the end of talking to them, I have a piece of meteorite and they all touch it on their way out of the auditorium. But I'm stealing a little bit of them because I touch them. They, you know, this is our future. You're looking into their faces and there's the future. if you can keep the notion of lyrical make-believe alive in their hearts, the most valuable adults I've known are still children in their hearts.
That's award-winning children's author Patricia Polacco. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Patricia Polacco visited Fox Creek Elementary School in Bloomington earlier this year. She's married to a chef who she immortalized in her book, Enzo's Splendid Gardens.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care. Heritage has been offering specialized health care services to seniors in Bloomington Normal for more than 50 years. On the web at heritageofcare.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a couple of interviews with authors who've written about the bicentennial of Illinois. December 3rd, the state turned 200. We'll have more of the origin of Illinois in just a moment. The gender columnist for the Washington Post came back to Bloomington Normal this year to promote her historical fiction novel and to receive a Distinguished Alumni Award from University High School in Normal. Monica Hesse talks about how she got the idea for this young adult novel called The War Outside. The setting is two girls in a detention camp in the U.S. during World War II, one German and one Japanese American.
So I had written a book a few years ago called Girl in the Blue Coat, which is set in 1943 Amsterdam. And I'm a really immersive researcher. It's my favorite part of any book. So I read a lot about the time period, and I was also reading about 1943 in other parts of the world and what was happening there. I came across a photograph that was, in a lot of ways, the most American photo you'd ever see. It was a young woman in a tiara sitting in front of a crepe heart, like a cheesy background that you'd see at a dance. And she had a sign that said Campus Queen. And I learned that she was the prom queen, and when the photo was taken, she was in an internment camp. She was a young Japanese woman who was the prom queen of her internment camp. And it made me really interested to know what kind of internment camp that would be and what kind of stories I'd find there.
A lot of people know about the Japanese internment camps, and a lot of people know about prisoner of war camps in which captured German prisoners were kept in various parts of the country, including north central Illinois, for one of them. But not everybody knows about people of German extraction kept in internment camps. How often did that occur?
The camp that I write about, the camp where this book is set, Crystal City, is the only camp that had both Japanese American and German American families. So there were a few other camps in the United States that had German American men. This was the only one that had women and children as well. And what differentiates it between the camps that you mentioned, the war relocation camps where Japanese American citizens were sent, is that this was run by the Department of Justice, and it was specifically for enemy aliens. It was specifically for people that the United States had decided were spies.
Families of spies.
Families of spies. And that's what makes the bureaucracy and red tape of it so horrifying and interesting in a lot of ways, because technically, when the women and children walked through the door to join their husbands, it was voluntary. When they walked through the doors to the camp, they were not prisoners. But as soon as they got inside the barbed wire, they were, and they weren't allowed to leave.
How are your protagonists, the Japanese-American girl and the German-American girl, alike and different?
I think that they're alike in the sense that they're both young women. One is 16, one is 17, trying to make sense of a world that's going crazy around them. And the questions that bring together are questions about patriotism and what it means to be an American. And how do you figure out who the real enemy is when your country has decided the enemy is you? And so I think that they have that common experience bringing them together, but they're from very different backgrounds. Margot, my German American character, is from a working class farm family, which was pretty typical of German Americans sent to these kind of camps. Haruko is much more worldly. Her father is a clerk in a fancy hotel who was sent to the camp because the government believes he was using his job to pass secrets between hotel guests. They're two young women who would not have met except in these extraordinary circumstances in this bizarre place.
Part of the struggle of an author's job in writing historical fiction is to not only reflect the period in which you're writing and the aspects of society at that time, but to find echoes in present-day society. How did you do that?
One of the things that I find really interesting about World War II is that we look at it as a time of black and white when we absolutely knew what was right and what was wrong. And when you go back and you read documents of the time, you realize that the people living through it saw a lot of gray and they weren't sure if they were doing the right thing. As I was finishing this book, we suddenly again were talking about internment camps in Texas. These internment camps were ones where we were imprisoning migrant children whose parents had tried to cross the border. And what was fascinating to me is that all of the moral arguments that we were having in 2017 and 2018 are nearly word for word identical to the moral arguments that they were having in 1941, 42, 43 as they tried to figure out the right thing to do. So I always feel like good historical fiction is as much about the present, because it's about the pain and the heartbreak of America and the cycle as we continually try to get better.
Would you read a passage? One
sure.
of your favorite passages?
I'll read the beginning of a chapter that actually a 16-year-old girl I met last night told me was her favorite passage. So I will read this for Nura. In the Crystal City camp, there is a federal school that is accredited so that the children who go there can have American educations. And so I will read just a page from Haruko's first day at the American school. "This is just a school," I tell myself. "This is just an American flag poking out of the ground in front of what is just a brick building. And this could be anywhere, really, except it's not." "You look darling," Chieko says, clucking approvingly at my rose seersucker dress. Chieko lives two victory huts down from us, and I met her last week, a few days after my family arrived at the mess hall. "It's Chinese rice," she said, watching me try to make sense of the strange texture of what they'd served us. "They don't understand there's a difference." Chieko plays tennis back home in San Francisco, she told me, and she has all the Glenn Miller records, and her father owns a film projector, which, she explained when we met, is used once a week to screen movies outside. "The camp employees choose for us, westerns, musicals, and they keep track of what we like. I learned this at my first movie night when a guard with blonde hair and freckles told his superior that my row had yawned 6 times during our screening of The Dancing Pirate. Nobody yawned during the newsreel that came before it. It might have been edited propaganda, but it was still a sharp, sudden taste of the outside world. 'Can you tell your sister to walk closer with us?' Chieko says. 'It looks bad, her being back there all by herself, like she couldn't find anyone to be friends with.' Chieko is exactly the right kind of friend for me to have here. She lent me a pair of socks with pink trim because they complemented my dress. She's been here since the beginning of summer. She knows everything about the camp. I should be so grateful to be friends with her. 'Toshi,' I call, 'come walk with us.' My sister can hold a grudge, and she hasn't forgiven me for slapping her. Every night we've been here, she's dragged her cot away from mine to sleep next to our parents in the next room. And so instead of walking to the washrooms with Toshiko in the morning, I walk with Chieko, who knocks on my window before it's even light. Someone is always there before us, holding their piece of cardboard to use as a privacy screen. 'It will feel normal,' Papa told me the first day, when I didn't know about the cardboard, and my mother and I took turns holding our skirts wide to block each other's stalls. 'It will never,' I thought. A week later, I check the latrine for crickets, and I urinate behind cardboard. But I tell myself every time that it's not normal."
How affected are they at that level of observation, if the guards are even keeping track of their unconscious reactions?
So that detail is the kind of thing that I could not have made up because it seemed so bizarre. But when I was researching this book at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., I found, among other things, the notebooks that the guards had kept keeping track of how prisoners responded to the movies that were being shown. The Dancing Pirate did not get good reviews. So I think that to answer your question of how people reacted, obviously there was a vast difference in terms of personality and in terms of family, but when you read personal accounts or listen to oral histories, you see the strain becoming to be felt in horrifying ways. You read about children watching their parents' marriages dissolve because their fathers, who were used to being providers, suddenly felt helpless that their families had been brought here and they couldn't do anything about it. Or you read about children rebelling just to have anything to do within the confines of this barbed wire fence. One of the things that I always remind myself is that World War II was happening on a massive scale, but that doesn't mean that people stopped being people. They still had these petty jealousies and human emotions. And I wanted to kind of explore what it would look like to have those emotions when you were in this magnifying glass of an experience.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Monica Hesse, the author of the book The War Outside, and a U-High distinguished alum. What does the pressure on these two young women do to the last couple years of their childhood and how it shapes them as they become young adults?
I think that you see both characters making decisions that they would find or would have found unthinkable before they came to the camp. Because they're being forced to make decisions beyond their years using what little information they have and the mistakes they make, which under normal circumstances would just be teenage mistakes that could be fixed with a little time, suddenly have ramifications for their entire lives.
Like what?
For example, one of the characters, Haruko, spends a lot of the book worrying about her older brother, Ken, who is a soldier in the Japanese-American unit of the Army, the 442nd Regiment, which was a real division. She knows something is wrong with him. He's sending letters that are increasingly strange and increasingly redacted, and she knows he's hiding something. I think in a normal time, she could go to her parents with these fears, but she knows how much pressure they are under, and so instead she feels that she has to be the one to fix it. She has to be the one to solve it. The other character, Margot, is going through family troubles in her own way. She's watching her parents' marriage crumble. She's terrified for her mother's health. Her mother's trying to hold on to a pregnancy after a series of miscarriages. What you see are two young women become two old women in a lot of ways because they know that their own families are under too much strain to deal with all of the problems, so they take these grown-up problems upon themselves.
Monica Hesse is a distinguished alum of University High School in Normal, a former feature writer for the Washington Post, and now the gender columnist for the Post. Her book is titled The War Outside.
It's been a while, and we miss you. Is it time to come back or tell us for the first time how much you appreciate GLT?
Baby, come back. Any kind of fool could see there was something.
Make a year-end contribution at WGLT.org.
GLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State's nearly 69% graduation rate is 23% above the national average. Illinois State's retention rate also remains among the highest in the nation at 80%. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're continuing a year-end special tour of GLT book interviews from Sound Ideas in just a moment with notable court cases in central Illinois. While the state of Illinois entered the Union as a non-slave state in 1818, for all practical purposes, Illinois embraced slavery at its founding. Frank Cicero, Jr. is the author of Creating the Land of Lincoln, The History and Constitutions of Illinois, 1778 to 1870. Cicero tells GLT's John Norton slavery was a legacy of the French inhabitants of the 1600s and Anglos and Americans of the 1700s. He says Illinois' first governor, first lieutenant governor, and president of the state's first constitutional convention were all slaveholders.
A lot of them came over from Kentucky, Illinois, as many of us in the North don't fully realize, is bordered by Kentucky and in part by Tennessee. In the southern part, a lot of slaveholders had come across from Kentucky, Tennessee, but also from other places in the East.
It is interesting how Illinois settled, because it did settle from the south and up into the middle of the state, and then later it settled in the north from New England and Europe. Here in the middle of Illinois, where we're at, we're like smack dab in the middle of Illinois in McLean County. You go about 30 miles south of here at most, and you can tell the south begins. Where you go north of that, it feels more like Wisconsin. And it's like Bloomington Normal is, and McLean County is almost the dividing line between the north and south, even in Illinois, not just geographically, but from how people settled the state.
That's correct. The settlement came up and from the south until the 1820s, 1830s, when the construction of the Illinois-Michigan Canal in the north began. There began to be a lot of immigration. A lot of Irish immigrants were brought in. A lot of people began coming in from across the lakes when the Erie Canal was finished in New York in 1825. Thereafter, settlement increased in the north and changed the character of the state.
It wasn't out of the question when Illinois became a state 200 years ago that it would enter the Union as a non-slave state. It was fairly close.
There were a lot of people who thought it should come in as a slave state, that the Constitution should permit outright chattel slavery. And in fact, two years, after the Constitution was adopted, an effort was undertaken to revise the Constitution in order explicitly to allow chattel slavery rather than the contrived devices that the 1818 Convention created.
Well, I'm going to get to that in just a bit. Let's go back to 1818. Slavery was not permitted by the Constitution in Illinois, but as you write in Creating the Land of Lincoln, essentially, it was slavery in the form of indentured servitude. Can you talk about how it came to be that slavery was outlawed, but indentured servitude was okay?
Well, the Illinois Constitution in 1818, like some others, had a paragraph flat out prohibiting slavery. And then it had several paragraphs of exceptions for so-called indentured voluntary servants. Now, indentured service was an old thing. It goes way back. English settlement used to come in with people who were contracted to serve for several years as a servant and so on. But this was different because they were blacks. Many of them were blacks brought in from other states. And the provision said if they don't agree to a voluntary agreement, quote-unquote voluntary agreement, they could be, within 60 days, they could be shipped back to the slave states. So they had no real choices, no real voluntariness. Many of the contracts were for 20, 30, 50 years, 99 years in some cases, and it was slavery for all practical purposes.
When what is now Illinois was part of the Indiana Territory and then the Illinois Territory, when that split off, and that was part of the Northwest Territory at one point, right?
Correct.
Wasn't part of that territory agreement that slavery would not be allowed?
The Northwest Ordinance in the Northwest Territory was not supposed to allow slavery. It was interpreted by the slaveholder officials from Ohio that meant slavery being adopted hereafter, after it became a territory or after it became a state. And that was the exception that basically was interpreted in Illinois. Illinois had been settled beginning 1690s and later by French who had slaves brought up from the Caribbean. And one of the exceptions of the prohibition, one of the permissions, was for people who had slaves who were born as the old French slaves, to continue as slaves. That was a condition also. Illinois was, before 1800, it was a county of Virginia for a short time. And one of the things that Virginia insisted on was that there be slavery permitted.
We're talking with Frank Cicero, Jr. He's the author of the new book, Creating the Land of Lincoln. It's the history and constitutions of Illinois from 1778 through 1878. And this is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. I want to move on and talk about the Illinois northern border and how that came to be. That's a fascinating political story in its own right, and it had major political ramifications on the state in its history. Can you briefly just outline how that northern border came to be?
Yeah, I think it can be outlined briefly. Under the Northwest Ordinance, which governed the old Northwest Territory, was intended to allow five states, three on a lower tier, and that turned out to be, of course, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, and then upper tier states. The provision, however, was that the northern boundary of those southern states, that is the southern tier, would have their east-west boundary, the north, through the southernmost point of Lake Michigan. And that would mean no shoreline. When the Illinois Act, when the Act came before the Congress, excuse me, to enable Illinois to form a constitution and become a state, one man, the non-voting delegate from the territory of Illinois, Nathaniel Pope, who was a Kentuckian by origin, got an amendment to the Enabling Act that said that the boundary would be extended 60 miles north of the southern tip of the lake. That included then Chicago, which would not have been in the state originally. It included what would be the mouth of the Illinois, Michigan Canal, which opened commerce down through northern Illinois to the Illinois River, to the Mississippi, and on to the Gulf. And that was achieved in 1818 in April by one man who garnered the votes in the Congress to make that change, a huge change. Without that change, Illinois would have basically been a southern state, much smaller, much less commercial development, et cetera.
Did he have the vision to know that an area right around what is now Chicago would develop because of that, the access to the Chicago River and the Lake Michigan shorefront?
Yeah, there were two things going on. Historically, the route from the Illinois River, which became split off as you went north into the Des Plaines River and the Kaskaskia River in Ohio, Indiana, those two rivers would be a route that would take you to Lake Michigan and on down to the Illinois River. There was a small area of 6 miles or so that was a portage between the Chicago River and Illinois River. That area became included within the state and enabled the development of the Illinois-Michigan Canal, et cetera. But it was a historically well-known trail, but the canal and that development opened up commerce to the south and opened up commerce across the lakes to the east and eventually resulted in settlement of northern Illinois.
Well, let's talk about that. So not only now do you have access to Lake Michigan and the Chicago River and ultimately then the Illinois River and the Mississippi, but it also, moving the border that far north, also included a lot of land now in northern Illinois. Did Pope have a vision that would have a difference for the state of Illinois as well?
Yes, he did. And that's one of the things that is remarkable, because the two reasons he expressed for making this boundary extension were, one, Illinois, if without it, will be a southern state settled from the south. And then he said confederacies like the United States were prone to disunion. And then in the event disunion happened, under those circumstances, Illinois would be a southern state and go with the south. On the other hand, he said, opening this area up will open up commerce to the north and the east, result in commercial development and so on, which will assure that Illinois is a northern state and will become part of any northern breakup, helping to prevent a southern breakup. Very, very remarkable foresight. Slaveholder from Kentucky in 1818.
Well, that was my next question. Was Nathaniel Pope a slaveholder, and was he a pro-slavery person?
Well, he was a slave owner for much of his life. He was the first federal judge in Illinois and was a federal judge for many years, from 1819 until he died in 1850. And for most of that time, yes, he still was a slaveholder.
Creating the Land of Lincoln is the new book by Frank Cicero Jr. He's speaking with us via Skype on GLT's Sound Ideas. Well, let's talk about that northern area of Illinois then, because it had huge political implications on the state. Did he understand that people from New England and Europe would be moving into that northern part of the state and change the dynamics of the politics versus, you know, the folks who settled the southern Illinois?
I think he did. He expressed that. First, some facts. The boundary amendment added 14 counties and 8,500 square miles. So it was not a small amendment. It was about, that territory is about, I think, 18 or 19% of what the state is now. Secondly, the Army engineers and others were talking about creating this canal to link the Illinois River to Lake Michigan and the Erie Canal. Everyone saw that coming. Mm-hmm. Great prospect. 1825 was the Erie Canal opening, and he saw that coming as well as did others, and that was what he was trying to enable.
And it did change the political dynamics of the state itself, where the southern part of the state was very pro-slavery, or at least pro-indentured servant, but the northern part of the state was more abolitionist.
You know, John, that's interesting, because when I first, I grew up in Illinois. I grew up in Cook County, but right down in the southwest part near the Illinois-Michigan Canal. And when I started to look at doing something on Illinois history, I picked up a book on the canal, and there was one sentence that said, the amending act, the enabling act, amended to add this territory to Illinois. And as soon as I found out how much it was, my immediate reaction was, holy cow, that's the area where all of these northern votes came from to enable the Republican Party. That's the area that in later years, of course, was dominated by Democrats in the North, but at that time it was an area that enabled the Republican Party to carry elections instead of the Democratic slaveholders from the southern part of the state.
Well, it's interesting what you write about in light of today's political climate, that the first Illinois Constitution allowed for both citizens and non-citizens to vote, and of course that meant just white males. What was the reasoning behind allowing non-citizens to vote back in when Illinois became a state?
Well, that was not only an issue in 1818. That was a big issue in the next convention in 1847 and a big issue in the two later conventions in the 19th century. The rationale was very simple. A lot of these people were landowners, and they did not have to be citizens, but they had to be white to vote, and they had to be either citizens or landowners. So that much of the land was settled by squatters and others who were landowners by possession or had become landowners. And that was an issue not only in 1818, as I said, it was an issue in other constitutions. And then it became political because the immigrants that were filling up the northern area with the import of 100,000 Irishmen to work on the Illinois-Michigan Canal and others, these people were not citizens. And the move by Republicans at that time was to allow the non-citizens to vote.
GLT's John Norton talking with Frank Cicero, Jr., the author of the new book, Creating the Land of Lincoln, The History and Constitutions of Illinois, 1778 to 1870. The Bicentennial Commission and the State Supreme Court Historical Commission decided to ask every county to highlight some legal cases that helped make the state what it is as part of the Bicentennial celebration this year. Enter Bob Bradley, retired Illinois State University professor and inveterate court watcher. Bradley is writing a book about these cases. He tells us what he helped pick for McLean County's contribution.
So Don Everhart, who is the circuit clerk for McLean County, got this notice and reached out to Bill Kemp, who's an ISU alum and is currently the librarian at the McLean County History Museum, that he wanted Bill to come up with these cases. Well, Bill then reached out to me and Guy Fraker to help him come up with these cases. One of those cases is currently being highlighted in the Illinois Courts electronic newsletter, which is the Illinois Courts Connect. And it's being used to sort of illustrate this process and also convince the other counties that they need to submit cases.
That case involves parking meters dating back to the 1940s. Tell us about it.
Parking meters was a technique for raising revenue in the cities that was developed in Oklahoma in the 1940s. And Illinois was one of the first states to seize on this as a way of raising revenue. And what ended up happening is an individual tried to park downtown around the courthouse, saw there was a parking meter. I think what ended up happening is he got ticked off because he couldn't, the meter wouldn't accept pennies. It was 5 cents, and it wouldn't accept 5 pennies, so he got upset and refused to pay the meter. Well, he subsequently was charged with violating parking regulation. A justice of the peace found him guilty. He subsequently appealed to the Illinois Appellate Court. The Illinois Appellate Court affirmed the conviction, and he was facing a $50 fine.
So this is a case over a nickel. It started as a nickel. Okay.
And he now owes $50 for that. And then from the Illinois Appellate Court, it goes to the Illinois Supreme Court. And it goes to the Illinois Supreme Court because it deals with a local ordinance.
Is he saying that government can't demand fees for parking?
Right. That's exactly what he said.
Why?
He said, well, it restricted his right to travel and his right to put a vehicle anywhere he wanted. It also said it was a denial of due process because there wasn't anybody there for him to argue with. And it was equal protection because he said there were other places in the city where people could park for free. Why should he have to pay for that particular spot?
Okay, but there were many cities and towns had ordinances about not allowing goats or not allowing horses other than at public hitching posts. So how was cars and meters any different than public hitching posts?
He would argue that he was being assessed a monetary fine for using something that he had paid taxes for. That he had paid taxes for the road, and why should he have to pay double? Why should he have to pay parking for parking when he'd already paid for the road because that's what his taxes went to?
Well, what's the history of user fees then? How far back do those go?
A ways, and that's actually what the Illinois Supreme Court ruled on. And the Illinois Supreme, because the Illinois Supreme Court had never dealt with a case dealing with parking meters before. But as part of their reasoning to approve cities' use of parking meters, they said that cities had, in fact, imposed user fees on various vehicles, like commercial vehicles, vehicles that had multiple axles. They imposed fees on them to use the roads, and that ultimately this was not any different.
Was this useful nationwide, or is this just an Illinois precedent-setting thing?
This case was actually cited not too long ago. There was an individual in Chicago who objected to being fined, and then he hadn't paid the fines, and so he was delinquent and argued while the city didn't have the right to impose parking fees. And this case was actually cited less than 2 years ago to support, yes, the city can impose can make you pay for parking.
So it's still living.
It's still living.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With me is Illinois State University Professor Emeritus Bob Bradley talking about interesting cases in McLean County that are part now of the Illinois Bicentennial observance and celebration. Your second case is of more recent vintage with it happening since I've been in town and covering it, with a woman sentenced to Norplant. Tell us about that.
Well, this is an individual, and this happened in the early 1990s, so this didn't happen that long ago. But you had an individual who was in her early 20s who hit her almost newborn baby in the head with a wooden music box, causing considerable cranial injury, and then took 2 days to bring the baby to any type of medical attention. The emergency room doctor was just simply amazed that the baby was still alive, given the extent of the injuries and the fact that it had taken 2 days to get medical attention to the baby. Well, the woman was arrested, tried, and convicted for a felony offense, basically battery on a child, and was sentenced to all kinds of things. But the thing that caught everybody's attention across the state and ultimately the nation was that as part of the sentencing, the judge ordered her to be surgically implanted with a contraceptive called Norplant.
And the judge in question was then Circuit Judge Ronald Dozier, a former state's attorney, a fairly conservative guy. But he was moved to do that because the woman had many children and had successively had them taken away from her for neglect or abuse in any number of circumstances. And he did not think it was likely that her choices would improve
right.
in her life. And yet, are they her choices or society's choices? And therein hinges the case. Tell us more about how it panned out.
A little bit more context of that is she had been in the state's care for a long time. This was an individual who had been diagnosed of having the mental ability of perhaps a 12 or 13-year-old, and she was in her early 20s. She had been sexually and physically abused throughout most of her life in various group homes.
It's tragic on all sorts of levels.
Right. And that was a big part of his reasoning, is why should I sentence her to prison and compound sort of the evil that the state has done to her? She's a product of the state's welfare system that had not gone well at all. And he felt some obligation to figure out some other way, to think out of the box on this. And he did, and came up, and for those who aren't familiar, NorPlant is, it's no longer available, but it's a contraceptive technique that consists of six cylinders being implanted in your upper arm, and then the cylinders basically time release a contraceptive over some years, and it's very effective. He did that. This raised all kind of ire with civil liberties groups. I was actually interviewed by local media about this because at the time I was teaching a course on science and the law that dealt directly with this. I actually had the judge come in and address the class on this and why he did it. And got to read something that a lot of people didn't get to see, was the judge, after he got all sort of the blowback on this, wrote an 11-page paper justifying his decision. And I actually read that because, for those who don't know, it is very unusual for trial judges to write written opinions on their decisions. And he actually did that. He appeared on national television shows on this, and it got a lot of notoriety.
And he's in an unusual position because as a Republican and as a fairly conservative guy, you would think he would not be on that side of the issue.
No. And that's the other thing that made it very interesting. And the ACLU got involved with this, tried to get him to take back his decision. The governmental institution that got ultimately directly involved with this was the Illinois General Assembly. And the Illinois General Assembly, within a year, passed an addition to the Illinois Criminal Code that said that judges, as part of their sentencing decisions, cannot order surgical procedures on defendants. And that still exists. That provision in the Illinois Criminal Code is still in there. And when they were debating it, they cited this case.
So how did the legal case play out?
The legal case played out that she was implanted. Down the road, she violated her probation on a variety of other ways and subsequently got more involved in the criminal justice system.
Did this have any sustained legal impact other than at the General Assembly level in the court system?
There were other judges across the country that did this. Based on this, they started doing, you know, ordering these types of surgeries for implanting contraceptives in cases like this. And what you had in various other states was a similar action by the legislature saying judges can't do this anymore. For me, an interesting legal issue was the idea of consent. And that is, did the individual involved have sufficient wherewithal to consent to this? Because this is a surgical procedure. And yes, she's an adult in the eyes of the law, but
and not
did
mentally.
She consent? Yeah, that's exactly it.
And when is the age of consent? Is it 12 or 13, or is it 8, or is it 16 or 17?
And is it based on your chronological age or your reasoning
mental
age?
Capacity, yeah.
Wow.
Retired ISU professor Bob Bradley talking about McLean County's bicentennial legal cases. Bradley is writing a book about the cases for the bicentennial involving all Illinois counties, all 102 of them. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with a year-end tour of book interviews you heard in 2018 on 89.1 and WGLT.org. Female police have made substantial gains in numbers and respect since entering policing in larger numbers in the 1980s. Illinois State University criminal justice sciences professor Dr. Kara Raby-Hemp's book addresses that. It's titled Thriving in an All-Boys Club, Female Police and Their Fight for Equality. Raby-Hemp says despite slightly declining numbers in this decade, female police officers are doing better. She tells GLT's John Norton the idea for the book came from a police lieutenant with 25 years' experience in a New Jersey police agency.
She had entered policing in 1981, so really early in the U.S. She was the fifth woman that was ever hired in her agency, so she wasn't the first. And I asked her, has anything impeded you or slowed you down in your progression? Which was hard to believe at the high rank of a lieutenant, right? That's a really high rank within policing. And she said this to me, and it really stuck with me. She said, I think one of the things that's impeded me or slowed me down is that police work is still a little bit of a boys' club, and I'm not a boy. So that quote really resonated with me, and I was curious if other women who policed had similar experiences. She'd had a 25-year decorated career, but she still felt like she was an insider or an outsider looking into the police culture.
And this was just, what, maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago when she made that comment?
I interviewed her about 10 years ago in 2007, and she was one of the very first women that I interviewed, and after that I decided I wanted to capture the stories of women that had entered policing in the 80s, the 90s, and 2000s, because we would expect some differences from the first in the 1980s to women today that are entering police ranks.
You're purposely focusing on the 80s and 90s in this book, but you cover a little bit of the pre-80s.
You got it.
Speaking even from the late 1800s and early 1900s, I was surprised to learn that there were not large numbers, but larger numbers of women in police and law enforcement than I realized back then.
You got it. What you'll find is that their tasks were very gender specific.
Right.
So you have, during wartime, for instance, you have women policing morality outside camps to make sure that prostitution and venereal diseases stayed at a very low rate during wartime. You also had women who were prison matrons who once, you know, the issue of female criminality comes into play and women are being housed in jails and in prisons. You have females being employed in the task to make sure that they're taken care of. Now, most of this, though, if you go back and look, was really featured around this issue of morality, that women should be maintaining the morals or allowing women to maintain morals within, you know, a prison or a jail that may not happen if you had men guarding them.
And they were more accepted back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, as you were writing the book, than they were when they really started hitting the American police force in the 1980s.
And I think the key to that is that we see women accepted within policing as long as they're doing gender-specific jobs.
Okay.
If they are in charge of female juveniles or female criminals, if they are working in the schools, if they're doing, you know, social work jobs, they're responding to female victimizations. These are tasks that, by and large, have not been, you know, crime-fighting, the crime-fighting ideas that we see in law enforcement. So as long as women stay within those roles, they haven't had as much difficulty. Once we see the 1970s, you see the Civil Rights Acts, you see Title IX being passed, and the opportunities legally for women in policing open up and women enter policing, that's when you see sort of the real obstacles and challenges to them integrating into a full police role begin.
When most of us think of Title IX, we think of women's sports at the high
yes.
school and college level. Did Title IX specifically address the issue of this, or was it just the spirit of Title IX? Is that what you're
the
getting
at? The spirit of that Title IX opened up the idea that
okay.
men and women needed to be equal in education and in other spheres. And so you see this mentality carrying over. Girls that went to school in the 1970s thought of policing as a potential employment in the 1980s. That didn't happen in the 60s or even in the 50s, by and large.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Dr. Kara Raby-Hemp, professor in the Criminal Justice Science Department at Illinois State University. We're talking about her new book, Thriving in an All-Boys Club, Female Police and Their Fight for Equality. And they weren't accepted by many people in the departments back in the 1980s when women were really starting to push hard to be police officers. There was a lot of pushback.
There was a lot of pushback, and some of that had to do, I think, with being first. And so in the 1980s, most women that entered policing in the late 70s to early 80s were the first in their departments. And so this might mean the first ever to be employed by the agency, the first woman to make rank, to be an administrator. It might be, you know, the first woman to be selected as academy class president at their field training or training experiences. And so being the first had its drawbacks, right?
But being a female was the real drawback, though, not necessarily being first, right?
Being a female was the real drawback, as sexism, discrimination was rampant. And there weren't really even, it hadn't happened to long enough that there were even solutions to this discrimination and sexism in those agencies. These experiences for women started at their police training academy experiences. It continued when they were in field training and beyond.
Can you talk about some of those obstacles they met? And sometimes it was just outright discrimination, where a police chief said there wasn't going to be any women in my department, to at the academy, even where there were obstacles, as you mentioned, that they weren't even ready for it to have female officers there. The uniforms, the locker rooms, and even basic things like that, right?
There were real challenges. One woman told me the story that there were no places in her facility for her to change her clothes. And so she brought this to the attention of her administrator. And so they opened a room, but you had to walk through the male locker room to get to the place where she could change her clothes. Oh, clearly, there were just agencies that were caught off guard and unprepared. There were others, of course, that quickly got up to par.
What was the impetus, again, I guess I could use that word, what was the impetus that allowed women to be integrated more into the force? Was it lawsuits? Was it people had a brighter vision of, oh, this isn't right anymore? Or did they have to be coerced into doing it?
I think all of those, you know, examples are true depending on the agency. It's hard to look at the 18,000 criminal justice agencies that we have and sort of make one answer. But, you know, in talking to women who entered in the 1980s, many of them had family in law enforcement. And so law enforcement to them was a profession that they really aspired to. And many of them told me stories about how they wanted to be a patrol officer since they were young girls. They had participated in athletics in high school. They had competed. They were physically fit, which is one of the major challenges still today for women in policing, is that the physical exam really favors male ways of knowing strength. In other words, upper body strength, which we know men favor physiologically. And so, you know, those were the sort of challenges in the 1980s. And very few women were successful in passing those exams unless they had some background in athletics or physical fitness.
But police don't have to be tested after they, leave the academy or join the police force? I mean, do they have to be tested every year?
As I understand it, some agencies now offer a sort of a bonus. I think Chicago is a good example of that. That offers sort of a physical fitness bonus if you continue to pass. There are state agencies that require yearly passing of the physical fitness test, but most municipal departments do not require their recruits, which I think, you know, you raise a good point that really questions the necessity of that level of physical fitness to do the job if the thousands and thousands of police that we have out there doing the job right now, you know, haven't passed that annual fitness test. And so for that reason, some people do believe that that has been held up as sort of a barrier to keep women out of policing.
On the other hand, that is part of the job. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get into a tough situation, and I could almost see, as a guy, I know women are physically weaker. If I get into a fight with three or four whatever people, does she have, you know, does she have enough strength? Does she have enough mojo to back it up? How have women proved themselves physically in the world?
So let's talk about that. One of the biggest barriers to women in the 1970s, and one of the reasons it took so long for them to enter mainstream policing, was really concerned about the physicality of the police role. So now, today, we know much more about how women do the job. And so I want to share with you some research.
Okay.
We know that women are great communicators. They're less likely to use force against citizens, especially excessive force, than male officers. We also know that their increased representation in policing has resulted in more peaceful police-citizen relationships. They're less likely to be named as in citizen complaints and lawsuits. This saves agencies and taxpayers millions of dollars. They're more likely to take reports of victimization for domestic violence and sexual assault and to follow up with those reports, reducing future violent attacks. So we know that women do a great job in the job of policing, is what it boils down to. They have had a very positive influence on the profession of policing. Some scholars argue that if we actually increase the number of women that we have in policing, that these sort of positive benefits will trickle down throughout the agency and will change the way that police do their jobs.
Illinois State University Criminal Justice Sciences Professor Dr. Kara Raby-Hemp's new book is titled Thriving in an All-Boys Club, Female Police and Their Fight for Equality. She spoke with GLT's John Norton. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Laura Kennedy and John Norton. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.